You know, one of the challenges in talking about the Counter-Reformation is that the title itself is a bit of a misnomer. It's not like the Reformation happened and then the Catholic Church all of a sudden decided consciously, intentionally to counter that Reformation and so created itself. The things that were happening in Northern Europe that gave life to the Reformation, that gave life to these new discussions and these new expressions of the Christian faith, were also happening in Southern Europe and in the places where the Roman Catholic Church remained strong throughout this period of Reformation and change. But there were different societal factors that influenced the direction it took. Mm-hmm. In Spain in particular, in 1492, the year that Christopher Columbus lands in the New World, is also the year that the Spanish finally expel the Moors from Granada. It is the first time Spain becomes a truly unified place. And it would take a while before that really, really happens, because Castile and Aragon are still different kingdoms, ruled by the same person for a while with the marriage of Ferdinand and
Isabella.
And Isabella, thank you. The woman whose name has gone in.
I can go home now.
Yeah, there you go. And for the Spanish, part of the process that happens religiously is now the Christian faith will be how they unify this kingdom. This kingdom that has all sorts of people and all sorts of subversive elements, people who may object to the way things have been going. They make the decision that the Catholic faith will be the way that they are unified. The Jews will initially be required to convert and ultimately expelled from Spain because of the threat they pose to that political cohesion. Muslims. This is 1492. There are lots of folks who are living in Spain who suddenly find themselves in a Catholic country, and who decide they don't want to take the risky and dangerous journey to some unknown place and say, fine, I'll be Christian. But this creates a fairly large body of folks in Spain who are civic Christians, what we might call civic religion. They've been baptized. They're Christians at least as far as the forms go. But there's always some doubts on the part of the Spanish hierarchy about how sincere they are. Because, as a general rule, forced conversions are not always sincere conversions. It's one of the reasons we gave that up. So Spain becomes this center of Catholic thought. You remember Philip II as being the husband of Mary, the first in England? Philip is a good guy. He does what he's told. Near as we can tell, his marriage to Mary was not his idea. But as the son of Charles V, the Holy Roman Emperor, he did what was required of him, married Mary. That didn't work out so well, but he survives her by a good long way. She, you'll remember, dies only in her late 30s. Philip briefly offers a marriage to Elizabeth, which is convenient for both him and Elizabeth because it makes them two. They can't be drafted to marry somebody else. For both of them, apparently, it's a convenient, excellent. No, I'd be happy to talk about marrying your daughter, but Elizabeth. And Elizabeth is, we should totally talk about marriage, but I'm working on that with Philip. It doesn't appear one of them were that interested, and especially where Elizabeth was a committed Protestant and Philip is a committed Catholic. It was probably never going anywhere from day one, but it was convenient. When that finally kind of falls apart, Philip turns his attention to Spain. And he becomes deeply, deeply committed to the process of bringing his kingdoms together, of making them one kingdom, which means he is going to make them Orthodox Roman Catholic if it kills him. The Inquisition gets its start with Ferdinand and Isabella basically as a way of testing. We have all of these people of questionable commitment to Christianity. And it begins by a way of trying to make sure that people are really deeply committed. of trying to make sure that the teaching is good, of trying to make sure that people who are teaching false doctrine are rooted out. And so, you know, oh, yes, you can be Muslim and Christian at the same time. You know, Christianity isn't that important, whatever they might have been doing at the time, are kind of identified and are not put in positions of authority, which would be pretty important to the Spanish throne in those days. It evolves into something very, very much different. It evolves into an enforcement of a particular way of being Christian that was punitive, that you had no problem burning heretics at the stake. Rather, you know, it was common. Use torture to elicit confessions. Eventually, they would ban all books printed outside of Spain because they were, Philip and the Inquisition together were determined that they would be united in thinking correctly and properly about the Christian faith.
Was Philip a religious man? I mean, was he?
He was a.
What I mean by that, was he well formed in any kind of way, or was he just a lunatic? Seriously.
Yeah, a fair question. No, he was just very, very deeply, deeply committed to Christian faith. How much of it? I think it's impossible to separate how much is personal and how much is political because
right.
The two don't have a clear dividing line for Philip or in that period.
There's committed to faith and there's committed to God. And you can be committed to faith and not be committed to God.
But not in this time period.
Yeah. Well, faith for faith's sake, you know, which is more political than religious, right?
Yeah. That's what I was wondering about him.
Right.
And it's a separation that doesn't yet exist.
Okay.
Part of this comes under, and unsurprisingly, Philip is pretty committed to the idea of authority, of the idea that there needs to be an authority, because how do you make sure that everybody cleaves to the right way unless you have somebody telling you what that right way is? So for Philip, the idea of papal authority is very, very important, because that gives him, that tells him what it is he should make all of his subjects agree to. I suspect he truly, truly believed he was saving all of their souls. And the only folks who were being punished by the Inquisition were those who were in danger of, betraying, drawing people away from Christ. The idea of a personal faith doesn't really exist yet. That's still a 100 years or so into the future. But it would, the interesting impact of the Spanish Inquisition and the effort to create homogenous religious belief in Spain is a flood of people out into the rest of Europe with all sorts of new and interesting ideas about faith. Because it turns out those questions that the Protestant reformers were asking and challenging up north are also being asked in Spain and in Roman Catholic countries. And so Spain actually, oddly enough, exports some of its most brilliant theological minds. And by holding the faith firm in Spain, allows the Pope to continue to hold the authority and the power that he had in the south of Europe, while also exporting all of this new and creative and interesting thought that still holds a sense of papal authority, but finds it prudent to not stay in Spain. One of those people is St. Ignatius of Loyola.
Speaking of Jesuits.
Ignatius is a courtier. You know, he gets the publicity around him is Ignatius was a soldier. But his first love, his first kind of calling was as a royal courtier, somebody who was going to work in the courts of the King of Spain, intended to move up through royal patronage. But in Spain at the time, the way you did that was military service. You couldn't be a proper courtier without having some military service. It's a little bit like we like to elect presidents who have served in the armed forces. Very similar. you'd be suspicious about anybody who talked a good game but hadn't actually served. You couldn't become a knight without military service. So Ignatius, whose given name was Inigo Lopez de Loyola, it actually becomes Ignatius through a scribal error when he enters the University of Paris.
I always thought it was just Romanized.
Yeah. Nope, the person registering him screwed up and misspelled it. He was stuck with it forever. but Ignatius enters into military service. He performs heroic service at the siege of Pamplona, which is in part of an ongoing dispute with France. They lose the castle, but it's a well-known battle, and the heroism of those who are defending it is highly recognized. But Ignatius receives some pretty severe injuries and is forced to spend a significant amount of time recovering. So he goes back to, you know, his parents' home. He ends up in the country house where it turns out there is, you know, no libraries and no ESPN. So he has to make do to entertain himself in these hours and hours of recovery with whatever books are available. And it turns out there's two of them. There's a 14th century book called The Life of Christ and a 13th century book called The Golden Legend. Most folks afterwards, this is making do with a children's Bible and, you know, and a pop culture anthology. They were important, they were popular, they were not exactly the kinds of works you would expect to produce a profound theological revelation. They were, you know, popular devotionals. You're recovering from surgery with Our Forward Day by Day. And that's the only thing you have to read. They're good as far as they go, but they're not what you would expect revelation to come from. But Ignatius makes the best of a bad situation. And Ignatius decides to discover what these works can reveal to him. And he spends hours meditating on them and reflecting on them. And he uses them in really imaginative ways to examine his own inner life and his own sense of calling from God. That period of time would result in a newfound sense of call from God to serve God, as well as a book that would later be called The Spiritual Exercises. That book continues to be used today by spiritual directors and all kinds of folks interested in discerning a call from God and in understanding their own spirituality and their own sense of who they are and whose they are.
Is it where we get the desolations and consolations and all that?
It is indeed. Among the things that it does is it asks those who are following these exercises to reflect on daily, you know, what are the desolations? Where is the sense where God is absent in your life? As well as the consolations, where have you felt God present in your life? If you've ever gone to a spiritual director and they haven't asked one of those two questions, then I'd like to meet them because I have never yet met one who doesn't. They're the beginning of spiritual direction. Unsurprisingly, Ignatius starts to write. He starts he recovers. The independent discernment that he's undergone, this notion of spirituality and getting relating directly to God, attracts the attention of the Inquisition, which tends not to trust that kind of independent spirituality because you don't know what's going to come out of it. Ignatius decides that it might be the better part of wisdom to spend some time outside of Spain so as not to be questioned too closely by the Inquisition, and he moves to the University of Paris, where he spends a couple of really fruitful years with all kinds of people having all kinds of ideas. France is a hotbed of all kinds of thought. It's officially Catholic. Its ruler, Henri II, is Catholic. But they have a pretty good-sized Protestant community and group there. They're not that far away from Calvin's Geneva. They're not that far away from Germany. So there's this all sorts of interesting conversation going on here. And he finds it really, really, you know, profoundly inspiring. He ultimately decides that he's being called by God, and in the process of discerning where that call could be, he ends up inviting some of the folks who he's talking to doing the spiritual exercises as well. In the process of their doing and using his guidance, they end up forming a group that decides that they are called to serve God. So they decide, well, we'll go to Italy and we'll embark for Jerusalem, because that's kind of was the thing to do. There's that whole sense of crusade. Let's go to Jerusalem. Let's make a pilgrimage. We'll see. God is obviously calling us to the Holy Land. They get to Venice, and there isn't a boat to be had. They're in the middle. Venice is in the middle of a trade war, and there are no ships going to Jerusalem. It could easily have been one of those moments when they just, oh, well, God's clearly not calling us and all gone home. But they decided that if they couldn't get to Jerusalem, what they would do is they would put themselves in the service of the Pope, and they would do whatever the Pope needed them to do. So they did. And it turned out that one of the things that the Pope would ultimately involve them in was catechism. Was that because while Ignatius was having his revelation and his new sense of discovery, a lot of other things were going on too. One of which is all of the ferment in the northern part of Europe and all of the Protestants and all of the discussions around, you know, how should we, you know, what is the Eucharist and how are people saved, made a bunch of Roman Catholics, folks who continued to be loyal to the Pope, realize that leaving the populace largely uneducated about their faith was a terrible idea. That if they didn't know what it was they were supposed to believe, they couldn't be expected to resist what many of these Catholics saw as the unjust and incorrect belief rejection of papal authority. So a bunch of folks began the process of, hey, maybe we should write a catechism. Mary invited an archbishop. One of the first ones came from a Spaniard that was invited to England to write a catechism while Mary was in power. And it's another one of those moments that had Mary lived, it would be interesting to know what would have flowed from that. The English catechism probably would have been the standard for the church. Mary dies, it gets put on the dust pile, but it would get resurrected again and again because it was good. And there was a guy named, I can't remember his name, Carrera. He became archbishop in Spain. It's one of the G names. Giovanni, that's it, thank you. Yes, Giovanni Carrera. So this idea of catechism, hey, here's a novel idea, maybe we should teach people about their faith. In Italy, an elderly priest gets the idea of luring young boys in by promising them an apple if they'll sit through an hour of instruction. Girls were apparently not promised the apple, but came anyway, which either shows the intelligence of the girls or that boys need to be bribed. I don't know. Unfairness. This idea of educating people becomes one of the mainstays of the Reformation because it invites people into a way of talking about their faith and experiencing their faith that is outside of the authority structures and yet still recognizes the authority of the church and the authority of the Pope. Mentioned that the Inquisition sent many of its, you know, most brilliant theologians. Juan Valdez, not the guy from Colombia, he's a 16th century Spanish theologian who is very interested in the interior life. He and Ignatius would have some similarities, and Valdez would actually inspire Ignatius in some of what he was doing, would arrive in Rome, having decided it was the better part of wisdom not to answer too many questions from the Inquisition. And so Rome becomes this place of all sorts of new and creative ideas. The Pope also, they get a couple of popes in there who are interested in reforming the church while they also, you know, take care of the political piece of it. But they become interested in hearing these new ideas, and we start seeing the formation of some new religious orders. The Ursulines would come out of this from a woman whose name I've forgotten.
Ursula?
No. That's why it's hard for me to remember. She founds it based on St. Ursula, who's a 13th century saint. But she recruits women to live lives devoted to service for God while remaining in their own homes. So it becomes, in what we would probably now call a lay order. They become under vows, but they live independently and they dedicate themselves to service for God. One of the archbishops in the area calls the clerical, his clerical colleagues, his clergy colleagues, to a new asceticism and a new sense of sacrifice. They become the and I wrote it down because you know I've got to forget their names. No, they're not the Carmelites. This is what happens when I don't put it in order.
Augustinians.
It begins with a T. It's not, and I'm getting Tridentine stuck in my head, and that's not the right word. Triestes or something.
I'm not going to.
No, it's absolutely not. And it's honestly, it's not important because you've never heard of them and you probably never will. But they become the model for the way the Jesuits will organize themselves. A sense of austerity, a sense of sacrifice, a sense of living simply while living in the world, while doing their regular, normal requirement. It's in part because it's a reaction against the over-the-top wealth and opulence of the Vatican court. And it's that, and it's sensitive to the calls for reform, to why the Protestants in the North have rejected papal authority, because it's been so over the top and opulent, it hasn't lived out the sense of service to Christ and the sense of being called to live simply and live in service. And so it becomes an enormously popular order for clerics, for priests, who make additional vows in addition to their vows as priests, to live in this austere way. And it would become the model for the Jesuits as they turn out to actually be pretty appealing to people, and they have to create a model for how do we live this way if we're not going to be an enclosed monastic group. So we start seeing these new expressions of monasticism that are not the traditional withdrawal from the world in order to pray and to hold themselves separate, but become living into service in the world, which would appeal strongly to Ignatius, who, having been a courtier and having lived in the world, was absolutely convinced that you know it was important for them to demonstrate that you could live a fully spiritual life without withdrawing from the world. So we start getting, and what makes these different from what's happening in the Reformation in the Northern Europe, is that they retain that sense of authority of the Pope. They want to keep the bishops. They understand, you know, pastoral authority and that apostolic sense of authority as being important, as being something that they want that for guidance. They want that to be where it comes, you know, to be kind of their rootedness. And, of course, there's always the tension that the political power is also with Spain, with Italy. It's in the church. There's a certain amount of how do we be religious, how do we reform the church, because we're not getting rid of it. That's clear. Which eventually leads to the Council of Trent. The Council of Trent is called in 1545. It will extend over multiple sessions over I think close to 20 years. It happens because Charles V manages to make some inroads, and the Habsburgs, we were mentioning the Habsburgs, And I don't remember exactly how. But the how?
Badly.
Yes, which meant that the Reformation, the Protestant Reformation tide, gets stopped.
We didn't get stopped. We get backed up with it. We were in the Czech Republic, and the Habsburgs right next door in Austria. It just hammering us back and back and back and back. We ended up in Holland.
Which means that the councils that get called are no longer interested in trying to find a shared way forward. There are a couple of disputations and discussions, you know, through the period when before the Habsburgs kind of make some inroads, that attempts to find some middle ground and some way that all the parties can agree to reunite the church. But once the Habsburgs and the French, you know, finally, you know, it becomes clear that they're going to be Catholic and they're going to stay Catholic, the Council of Trent gets called, and the Council of Trent is not interested in finding an accommodation. Whatever moment may have come has also gone. So what the Council of Trent does is reaffirm a number of doctrines that were central to Roman Catholic understanding. They would reaffirm that Eucharist makes Christ really, truly, substantially present, which is, of course, the doctrine we still know today as transubstantiation. They would reaffirm the Roman Catholic sense of justification. Both, you'll recall, both Protestants and Catholics would insist that grace begins with God. That human beings, as sinful creatures, cannot save ourselves. That we are dependent on God's grace offered to us through Christ's crucifixion and resurrection to be saved, and how that happens. Protestants would insist that there was absolutely nothing human beings could do to help this process along.
They were very big on that. All sorts of sections of Protestantism, all they talked about.
Sin, well, it is Luther's doctrine of total depravity, which you may recall we talked about a couple of weeks ago, that everything is so marred by sin, human beings can't, you know, if they have a choice to make, they will choose wrongly. There is absolutely nothing human beings can do to do this. Roman Catholics insist on holding on to the sense of the freedom of the will. They hold on to, they say, yes, grace begins with God. God offers his grace through baptism, through the sacraments, through the cross, and human beings have to accept it. There is an ongoing process of justification that human beings are participants in. And the way you participate in it is through charitable acts and through participation in the sacraments.
Right. Acknowledging God's presence in your life, turning from the throne. I just want to interject for a second. This has always helped me understand this justification thing. There's the throne of grace. There's God there, right? And God enables us to do things. But we can have more grace, or we can do whatever if we turn our individual will towards that. So we actually do have an individual will that enables us to work with God or work out with God. And then the other hand,
I was going to say, Calvin in Geneva was not nearly so optimistic.
No.
But that would remain one of the prime differences between the Reformed churches and the Catholic Church, is that sense of how we are saved. The Catholic Church reaffirms there are seven sacraments. Protestants had said, well, the only sacraments are the ones instituted in the Bible by Jesus himself, which is communion, Eucharist, and baptism. So they ditch ordination, they ditch marriage, they ditch confession, confirmation, and I always miss at least one, so... Yep. Yep, extreme unction, which we retain as healing prayer, anointing of the sick. You may have noticed Protestants keep marriage. they don't consider it a sacrament. There are a lot of those things that get kept. So Council of Trent does that. Council of Trent also finally settles, puts to rest once and for all, what books of the Bible are in the Bible. If you're sitting here going, wasn't that settled before that? It had never been officially stated. There were lots and lots of writings in the early church. That's how we get the Gospel of Thomas, the Gospel of Mary, all of these other Gospels that resurface every now and then, in usually on the morning news programs, with the, there's another Gospel! By the way, none of this is new to anybody who studied the Bible. We all knew they were out there. They just didn't get copied as much, so sometimes we don't have complete copies of them. Nicaea had actually done some decision-making around which ones are we going to include, which ones aren't we going to include, which is how we don't, why the Gospel of Thomas does not appear in your New Testament.
I thought that's when it was decided, it was Nicaea.
They did, but they didn't set it in stone. They said, these are the ones that we understand to be speaking the truth. But they didn't say you couldn't read any of the others. When Luther came along, he read some of these books, and he went, there's no way these should be part of the Bible. He basically argued with Nicaea, rejected a bunch of them. If you pick up a large annotated Bible today, you'll find there's a section of Old Testament, between the Old Testament and the New Testament, called the Apocrypha, which are largely first century writings. The reason it's called the Apocrypha is the Protestant churches following Luther said, no, these are not the Word of God. They're useful for learning, but they are not Scripture. The Council of Trent said, oh, yes, they are. so if you find sometimes you'll often find Bibles prepared for Protestant congregations. I suspect our New International Version Bibles here, you won't find that Apocrypha in it at all, because the Reformed churches followed Luther and said, there's no way these are actually Scripture. They may be useful for learning, but they're not Scripture. Whereas Bibles printed for Roman Catholics will include it without comment. And it's Maccabees,
Wisdom, Sirach.
There's I think five books there. Most of them are around first century Jewish writings. Tobin and Judith. Yep.
Yoda? I don't think so.
That one comes later. We'll need another concert to decide on that one.
That was a real hidden God.
The Gospel according to Yoda. That would be fun. So the Council of Trent, they reaffirm ordination as a sacrament, and tackle the question of the authority of the Pope, although they end up fudging that. The idea, by the way, the idea of papal infallibility doesn't show up until the 19th century. It's a new doctrine. The Council of Trent was not prepared to go there.
You should mention, too, that papal infallibility means that whenever a pope comes out with an important document, that is considered infallible. It's not that he always is infallible, but when they present a certain document, that's considered infallible. So they mull over that stuff.
Yeah,
but amazing how that's been misinterpreted.
I think so,
It gets heavily, and I think that's actually one of the reasons why the Council of Trent didn't want to go there, is because it ended up putting too much authority in a fallible human being, and there was a question there of discernment of, when is the Pope truly acting within the tradition with what has been passed down to him, and when is it his personal things, feelings and thoughts influencing that, which I think is probably one of the reasons why the Council of Trent didn't want to go there. That and a bunch of the other bishops didn't really want to give the Pope that much power. Given their recent history, that's probably understandable, since corruption had been a major problem in the papacy in the century leading up to the Council of Trent. The Council of Trent would finalize and put in permanent place the division between Protestantism and Catholicism, because neither party was able after that point to ever really seriously talk about the things that divided them. Ironically, I think probably most Protestants and most Catholics are a lot closer now on most of those things than they were certainly in at the Council of Trent in the 16th century. I think if you went to, most Protestants will say there's something special about communion. And most Catholics will say, yeah, it means Jesus is really present, but, you know, maybe not transubstantiation. I know a lot of Catholics who because they don't have that Greek understanding of substance that the church had, you know. If you got into the discussion of substance, most Catholics would probably be willing to go with it, but then again, so would most Protestants, and definitely most Episcopalians.
Yeah.
You know. So we're actually much closer together on the issues that divided us at the Council of Trent than you know, probably we've been in the last 400 or 500 years, with the exception of some of the more, you know, the more Reformed churches, the evangelical, the churches that are further away from the Episcopal tradition. Certainly in the Episcopal Church, if we sat down with Francis and talked about the things that we decided at Trent, we'd probably be willing to sign on to most of them. We'd probably be comfortable with them. As it happens, and as always happens in the church, there are a number of other things that have come up in the meantime that we probably wouldn't be able to agree on. One of them is the fact that I stood at the altar and celebrated today.
That is really important. I think that half the reason why we're able to agree on it is just a modern communication.
Yeah.
We experience one another's presence so much more. We're always in contact with one another. So I think that's one reason why we're able to get along. And that partially is a fruit of the Protestant Reformation. You know, because Protestant Reformation enables certain democratic things to go on.
Yeah.
Let's people read the Bible. Let's the people sing songs that they like. You know, there are things that the Protestant Reformation sets in motion.
Yeah. And we end up, you know, it's interesting. My Roman Catholic relations, I have a few by marriage, are always stunned and shocked when I know all of the responses when I go to Mass. It turns out that when we get into the 20th century and we get to Vatican II, that's a time period when of liturgical renewal in a lot of churches, in the Episcopal Church, the Lutheran Church, and the Roman Catholic Church, and we all go back to the same documents, and we discover the early church services, and we end up modeling our liturgies on what was happening in the early church, and we end up with practically the same service. The Tridentine Mass that Pope Benedict talked about, and that was that conservatives these days want us to go back to the Tridentine Mass, the Latin, the language, that is the renewed and reformed Mass offered by the Council of Trent. It was a reformation. It was a way of reaffirming the doctrine of the Eucharist, of reaffirming the participation of the laity in Eucharist, and that the Mass was the sacrifice offered. So it turns out it's 15th century, 16th century. Sorry. going back, and Vatican II, actually, interestingly, we all went back earlier than the place where our differences were, and came up with something that's very, very similar. The other fruit of the Reformation is the missionary movement. Because, remember that date, 1492? Spain also becomes a power and begins moving into North and South America. The Protestants wouldn't really catch on to the whole notion of missionary work for another century or two because they were busy trying to defend themselves from locally. They were really internally focused, working out their differences and trying to come up with, you know, some way to be church in Europe. While the Spanish were sending Dominicans and Augustinian friars behind the conquistadors to the New World. This bore different kinds of fruit. Unfortunately, there was a fair amount of cultural imperialism in all of this. The evangelization of the natives often involved, you know, the Inquisition and the destruction of native culture, which was seen as pagan. But it also, because it starts so early and because it's done by a lot of remarkable individuals, it also produces a very uniquely New World native Roman Catholicism. The Virgin of Guadalupe comes out of that process.
That's a part of the Roman Catholic Catholicism is actually part of the whole. And one of the things that the Catholic Church emphasizes is that when they come across a new culture, they respect the local culture. It's not just the Catholic Church does this. It's the Catholic Church does it within a certain cultural context.
The very first theologies of mission come out of this time period, with positive and negative results. The Europeans' colonial enterprise was some positive, a lot negative. There was lots of the friars also burned every Mayan codex they could get their hands on, which is why we can't read most of the Mayan writing today. It's not all good. But they also produced some of the first people to stand up and defend the rights of the native populations. You know, they also produced some of the first anti-slavery preaching and folks opposed to slavery.
Oh, the sacrifice of humans. I mean, all that done when Juan Diego in
Guadalupe. Yes.
He sets the whole country on fire for Catholicism. All the Mayan sacrifices gone.
Yeah. You can easily view it as the roots of liberation theology. Mm-hmm. You know, which in the 20th century would challenge a whole lot of ideas about how we deal with people without power and with minority groups. It leads to black theology, it leads to women's theology, it leads to all sorts of interesting things.
It's hard for me to grasp that, and the whole basis of it is that you were conquering a culture and declaring it substandard or inferior to what you were going to impose upon them.
I think it probably has as much to do with the adaptability of the gospel to different settings. I think those who heard the gospel often heard something other than what those in power would have wished they would hear.
Sure, it's always
isn't that always? And end up incorporating it into, end up adopting it, incorporating it, and bringing their own sensibilities and their own knowledge to it. Mm-hmm. It would take a while for that to emerge. Because the first folks who would come, you know, were interested in suppressing native culture. Mm-hmm. But as later folks arrived and as mission began to move into places where they didn't have quite so much military power, such as Asia, new models of mission, of living with people and understanding their cultures, would also take root. So it ends up kind of this mixed bag of, in some places, military might led to the destruction of cultures and the imposition of Christianity. In other places where the Spanish military was otherwise occupied, it led to a new way of sharing the gospel that, for instance, Jesuits in China, dressed as Confucian scholars and worked with, scholars in the Chinese court, learning from them as well as teaching them. So it turns out one of the things that the fruit of the Protestant Reformation is that we would never be monolithic again. Is that even in the Catholic Church, even in the Roman Catholic understanding, we would have increasingly new and different expressions of what it meant to be Christian. And eventually,
that's a psychological thing. You know, I don't fully understand that. Sometimes I feel like I like monolithic ideas. Other times I can totally understand why the world's a very complex place. You can't possibly agree upon everything.
Mm-hmm.
You know, do you have any idea of what you would say about that? Or?
All 30,000 different Protestant denominations. I think it is the fruit of it that we would, you know, that there is no longer one way to be Christian. I don't know that there ever really was. But it becomes very much part of the Christian tradition. It's part of what lets the missionary movement ultimately take hold. It's part of how we can be part of the Anglican Communion, praying for the church in Sri Lanka today and the church in Uganda last week. Knowing that all of those expressions are often different from us, that we don't always agree. In fact, there are times when I know that we probably are closer to the Unitarian Church up the road than the Anglican Church in Uganda about some things, and vice versa. sometimes we will be closer to the church in Uganda than we are, you know, to another expression of Protestantism like the Unitarians. And that's you know, kind of the fruit of the Reformation.
I think just that exposure to different thoughts and beliefs allows us that opportunity to confirm our own personal. Because I think that if you have an opportunity to hear somebody else's perspective, you sometimes agree. Sometimes you disagree and it confirms where you are, but I think that opportunity to recognize God being experienced differently allows us to sometimes experience God differently.
What I find fascinating about that is that I think we could all sit here today and say, that's a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
But
what do I do with it?
Well, but now getting to this point over the centuries, to me, it's just loaded with ironies.
Yes.
I can't sit here and listen to discussions about, for example, the formation of the Jesuits without seeing and thinking about how ironic all that has been over history. So, you know, having been educated in a Jesuit college, you know, what we were told about Loyola was not that he learned from books, that he had spiritual experiences and visions and so forth. And it is true that the Jesuits were known and still are for education.
Mm-hmm.
And that was their means of helping people attain grace, was through education, right? And that it meant to be of the world. And how important it was to be of the world. Except that then when you moved into situations where it didn't quite work for the hierarchy. So Robert Drynan is a congressman, openly opposed to the Vietnam War in the 70s. He's of the world. He's serving in a political seat, he's helping to make political decisions, he's reaching out to people in the world, and the papacy declares, you can't be a politician anymore, choose one. Well, I want to be of the world. No, you can't be of the world, you can only be of the church. You know, how ironic is that it was founded of individuals to be of the world to help bring education, yet they were, you know, drawn back in. And you can almost say we've gone back the other way now with this pope.
One of the problems with the modern world is that with these interlocking relationships, being of the world is very complex. You know?
Sure,
you know,
sure.
It's hard to tease out.
It's complex then, you know.
public figures is very obvious. The lines between people become very clear with public figures because there are certain very clear lines they must acknowledge, you know, but in private morality, things are very clear.
It was complicated then, too. You remember I talked about Archbishop Carrera,
mm-hmm.
who produced the English Catechism? He came back to be archbishop in Spain, ends up arrested by the Inquisition, dies in prison in Rome, mostly because they shipped him out of Spain because the Inquisition, because they were so worried about what would happen to him. A couple of years later, after his death, Spain finally creates a catechism. What do they base it on?
Yep.
Carrera's English Catechism. The struggle to figure out what does it actually mean to live this way would actually become one of the hallmarks of the Jesuits. And it's one of the reasons why the Jesuits have been a thorn in the side of as many popes as they've been supportive of. That tendency to think for themselves and to challenge the structures that are there. At the same time, being loyal and faithful and committed to service.
Talk about how to walk a line. It's astounded me how that's happened. Survived over the centuries the way it has.
And I think the Jesuits in part similar orders because they do tend to be a little bit more open and a little bit more of a look. And they are choosing to walk that line.
Yeah.
It's worth noting that Francis is the first Jesuit pope.
Right. Yeah. I never thought we would see a Jesuit pope. I absolutely never thought it. Because I just figured the college would never assent to that because, you know, he's too much of an independent thinker.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which, you know, to my mind, points to the presence of the Holy Spirit in all of this. You know, in
what else could you conclude?
You know, we end up...
Yeah.
So, yes. Yeah, with a curious sense of irony. And that sense of faithful people, no matter where they fell on the spectrum, no matter how they were thinking about the important issues, feeling drawn to God's service, feeling desire to serve God. It ended up with a lot of very different expressions at times.
I think one of the
but that was a key thing.
Last time, but I wasn't here. But for me, one of these keep in mind the problem of reparation. It's not only Protestant, but I definitely, you see it in the settlers of America, this idea of Christian perfection, that we were working on learning how to love one another in more mature ways, and things like that. You know? So in ways that make us broken. You know, and the only reason why I bring this up is because I have a spiritual director who's big on this. And he scored points with all sorts of people in his circles because he said, look, you've got to learn how to love one another. And that's a big part of Protestant Reformation, is that these people get together in community and work it out. You know, that's the thing about Christians. They call it Christian perfection. The Puritans all came to do. They all came together, they kill all the Indians, and they love one another.
And you know, and you can see throughout this whole process how imperfectly we do that.
Yeah.
And maybe how God keeps calling us back to seeking that service, seeking that love
it
for one
another.
It does seem
to be the constant. Is of all the inconsistencies and the ironies, that's the one constant, is that eventually somebody breaks through with the message that this is not how it should be. It should be a basis of belief in God and a movement through the Holy Spirit that grounds you. Not an individual, not a set of orders, not a set of rules. Yeah, I'm thinking that, you know, this discussion we just had about this Pope. I don't believe that this college of, you know, septuagenarian, octogenarian cardinals suddenly woke up and said, "Hey, let's elect a Jesuit."
Yeah.
Something moved them to do that.
Yeah, that was definitely out there.
Yeah.
Well, I think one of the things that probably with them is what Cardinal O'Malley said to his Pope, to his priests. Expects obedience, you know, and Protestants believe obedience too, obedience to God, you know, and I think what the Catholic Church is saying, yeah, but there are ways to make that obedience more clear, you know, and the Church is an instrument of God working in ways to make that obedience more clear.
So we retain differences, we retain different ways of coming to God, but we do. In the end, if the Reformation was about coming up with the one true answer, the right way to come to God, then it was a complete failure.
Exactly. That's but, one thing you could definitely take away from that. Yeah.
But if what God was doing was welcoming people in all of our diversity, then seeds were planted that would lead us further on.
Okay.
Okay.